I want to thank the organizers and Sandy. I say a few words about how beautiful the new building is, but I haven't seen it yet, so I'll have to reserve my comments. But I'm going to give today an introduction to operator spaces to give you some sort of feeling for what these things are and why people study them. And I think that I should begin by mentioning, of course, why we call them quantized Banach spaces. And you'll recall that Heisenberg was the one who discovered that if you want to get a correct view of physics at the atomic level, you have to use the same rules like F equals MA, but you have to reinterpret the variables. The variables are no longer functions. They are infinite arrays of numbers, matrices, or more precisely, self-adjoint operators. And this, of course, was a and very dramatic revolution in physics, and probably more so than even relativity. And it's generally accepted by all physicists that this is the correct procedure. Von Neumann, in the early 30s, remarked that, well, if it's so effective and so important in physics to replace functions by operators, you should consider doing the same in mathematics. And he began with Murray by writing a long series of papers in which they studied non-commutative integration theory, you might call it. That's probably the most accessible of the areas that you can quantize. And after the war, and especially into the 70s, you began to see things like non-commutative geometry, even more non-commutative probability theory. There's the very dramatic notions of free probability theory now, which are making a tremendous impact on operator algebra theory itself. But the simplest thing to quantize, it turns out, is functional analysis itself, or the notion of a Banach space. One of the problems with quantization is that it's a one-to-many map. And there are many different quantizations in general, and it can be very confusing if you have a dynamical system, a classical one, to decide upon what your quantized system is. But in the case of quantizing the notion of a Banach space, there seems to be a very simple, almost canonical procedure for doing this. And the idea behind it is that, I have to introduce some notation. Incidentally, do we have a pointer here that will point up at the screen? Perhaps not. I can just use it. So in any event, let me... I'll just point at the... thank you.
It extends.
Oh, it does? Okay. I don't think it'll extend that far. So, it's okay. So the... let me begin with some notation. These are the n-tuples with the soup norm. They're going to be replaced by the obvious space of operators, the n by n matrices. From the C-star algebraic point of view, this is quite natural because you're replacing a commutative C-star algebra by a non-commutative one. And more generally, we'll replace the L-infinity functions on a set S by the bounded operators on a Hilbert space with the dimension of H equal to the cardinality of S. Now, one of the key differences between these two has to do with these parallel constructions. We have that an n-tuple of functions is again a function on the disjoint union of the spaces, F1 being defined on S, Fn being defined on S. I'll just call that Ns. On the other hand, matrices have a corresponding construction for matrices of operators. If you have a bunch of operators and you take a matrix of operators, that can be regarded, again, as an operator on the Hilbert space raised to the nth power because you can just multiply in that usual, obvious manner. So let's go on to the... Given a Banach space, or let's take the simplest case of all, let's notice that this procedure I have over there gives you an isometry between these Ln infinity of L infinity of S with L infinity of Ns, and similarly, this construction over here tells you that there's a natural way of regarding the n by n matrices over B of H as the bounded operators on H to the n. But the key difference between these two constructions is that, on the one hand, in the Banach space case, you're not gaining anything new because you can compute the norm of F in the usual way. It's the maximum of the entries of that n tuple. But for n by n matrices, it is not, you cannot compute the norm of B from the norm of the Bijs. The norm of the entries do not determine the norm of B. That's new information that's associated with an operator space. An operator space has this is a special case of an operator space, has this extra baggage, extra structure. You have to worry about norms of matrices. Well, let's get down to what we're really interested in. One way of thinking about a Banach space is that it's just a function space. A function space is a closed subspace of of L infinity of some set. That's always true. Every Banach space arises as a subspace of L infinity of a set, because you can just let S be the unit ball of the dual space. And so it's clear that there is a very simple analogy to this. Well, let's call an operator space or a quantized Banach space to be simply a closed subspace of B of H, the obvious analog. But now we see this crucial difference that when you have a Banach space, all you obtain is simply a norm. That's the only structure that's relevant, is the relative norm. But when you look at an operator space, you have to also look at n tuples over the operator space, because there's more information here. You have to worry about the norms of the n by n matrices. Since Mn of V will be contained in B of Hn, you'll have that there's a corresponding norm. So therefore, we have the notion of a quantized Banach space. A quantized Banach space is a vector space together with a norm on each of these matrix spaces. This was axiomatized by Ruan in his dissertation. You only need two axioms, which are quite analogous to the axioms for a norm space. There's one for additive sums, or here it's direct sums, and there's one for scalar multiples. Now, however, you have to worry about what I mean by these symbols. V plus W is the direct sum of the matrices, and now we can consider scalar multiples where the scalars are themselves matrices. Alpha, V, beta, we have the matrices of scalars times the V times the matrix of scalars. And you see above the axioms are, for an operator space, Ruan's axioms are stated in terms of those. And what Ruan's theorem says is that if you've got a vector space and you've got norms on each of these n by n matrix spaces, then you can realize that system as a subspace of B of H for some Hilbert space. So this is the way that we find the abstract version of an operator space. We could call this the axioms of a quantized Banach space. Here again, when we pass to the linear morphisms, we have to take the linear mappings. We have to pay attention to all of those matrix norms. They're an essential part of the structure. And the way that's done is that if you have a mapping from V to W, it automatically gives you a mapping of the n by n matrices, and you just send an element into the corresponding element. And now, in contrast to the situation for Banach spaces, these norms might very well be increasing. The very first norm might be isometric, and then you might find that these norms are going to infinity. And they're very simple examples of that. But the thing I want to stress is that what we do is we pay attention to the uniform norm, the completely bounded norm, the supremum of all of those matrix norms. And we say that your mapping is completely bounded if this thing is less than infinity, completely contractive if it's less than or equal to 1, and completely isometric if all of these are isometric. That's the notion of a morphism in this category. And what we will do is we will denote those mappings by the completely bounded mappings by CB of VW. Classically, the Banach space case, you would just look at B of VW. And a special case of the mapping space would be the dual space, the bounded mappings of V into the complex numbers. So there's the dual. And here's a little calculation to show you that as Banach spaces, and that's all we've defined, this completely bounded mappings from V into C, there's a natural completely bounded norm. That thing over there is the same as your usual dual Banach space. And the way it's proved is you have to show that those inequalities over there, in fact, stabilize when you have a function into the complex numbers. In fact, all the norms are the same. And the calculation is very simple. We simply look at the corresponding n version on the n by n matrices. You're applying it to an n by n matrix. And we have to find the norm of that matrix. And the way you find the norm of a matrix of scalars is that you simply figure out what matrix this is. That's F of the Vijs, and these are n tuples. And you can just multiply those matrices out. Remember, these are scalars over here. We can write it in this form over here. But what we have now is a whole bunch of scalars, summation. We can take the F outside, and you get summation Vij, A to J, Xi. That can be written as a matrix product, where this is a vector in Hilbert space written as a column. This is your n by n matrix. This is the corresponding transpose matrix, row matrix. And so here we have a 1 by 1 matrix, a scalar, and we have the norm of F controls this. And thank you. The norm of F does control that. And then we take the norm of this triple, and by this rule over here, the Ruan's rule up over there, that's dominated by the norm of alpha, norm of V, norm of beta. I should emphasize on that this norm of alpha is the norm of the n by n matrices in the usual sense, and it can be applied to rectangular matrices. That's considered as given that we know what our norms are on n by n matrices of scalars. Okay, so going on from there, that shows you then that these two spaces are the same. Completely bounded maps from V into the complex numbers are equal to V star. But one of the key discoveries in the area was that you can actually define a very natural norm on matrices of mappings. What I want to do is I want to turn this completely bounded map, CB of VC, into an operator space itself. Going back to Banach spaces, you know that if you take the bounded maps from E into F, that's another Banach space. So we want to have the same situation here, that when you take operator spaces, CB of VW, we want that to again be an operator space. And the way that's done, this was discovered by Bletcher and Paulson and Jean-Jean and I were also involved with this too, these notions of how you define an operator structure on this. Look, if you have an n by n matrix of mappings, you can again consider it as a mapping. Namely, you have these Vijs mapping V into W. This you just regard as going into the n by n matrices. In other words, the Vijs are applied to V. These are in W. So this is in the n by n matrices over W. So once you do that, you can regard this mapping phi as a mapping between operator spaces. It's easy to see. The n by n matrices over an operator space is an operator space. And so therefore we obtain a norm. We can an identification of the n by n matrices. You can show it's the same as the completely bounded maps from V into the n by n matrices. And we can this has its given norm. So this has a corresponding norm. It's easy to see. It satisfies Ruan's axioms. And therefore, it is an operator space. A particular case of that would be the n by n matrices over the dual of a Banach space. It's a good one to practice with. That's going to be the completely bounded mappings from V into the n by n matrices. If you're given an n by n matrix of linear functionals and you apply it to a vector, you'll get an n by n scalar matrix. Okay? And we use the completely bounded norm over here. And here's just giving the quantifiers. Let's see. When you want to define... this is an additional piece of information I want to point out here, and that is that When you're working with a Banach space, the linear functionals will actually give you the norm of x in the usual way. This should be e over here. You take the sup of the f of x with f a contraction. There's a corresponding result for operator spaces, but now you want to give the norm of an n by n matrix, v equals vij. And you have a corresponding result, but you have to use functions into matrices. These are the n by n matrices over v star. This is the unit ball. That, remember, is the completely bounded maps from v into the n by n matrices. So you can obtain the norm of this n by n matrix by applying this function over here. It's a little bit tricky because you have to remember that v itself is an n by n matrix. F is an n by n matrix. This matrix that you're getting over here is actually an n squared by n squared scalar matrix. Just a slight technicality. This is a very awkward procedure when you first see it. And in fact, in the very beginning of the subject, in the 80s, Barry Johnson wrote a letter to me. And over the years, we discussed it and tried to see if we could make a more elegant approach. His idea was, why not throw all the n by n matrices together? Why not just work with modules over the compact operators? And about a month ago, I guess many of you heard Barry Johnson died about, in the spring, and Alan Sinclair sent me Barry's notes. I had already seen most of them already, in which he was apparently still working on this idea. Is there some way of getting rid of all this nonsense of having to worry about all the levels? And I'm telling you, it is a nuisance sometimes that you have to keep thinking, well, what about the n by n, the nth level? And you try to find ways of getting rid of that without thinking. Okay, so we want to go to this one. So his idea was, why not just consider modules over the compact operators? In fact, he characterized in that at that very early period. So here I'm writing it down what his thinking was. Instead of considering this chain of matrices, that inclusion over there means that the 2x2 matrices are stuck in the 3x3s by putting zeros on the last column and row. And then we take the M infinity to be the union of those, or the direct limit in the more precise sense. Or even further, you can take uniform closure of the these finite matrices and get the compact operators and define K of V. And you just regard that as a Banach space. In fact, you regard this thing as a module over a bimodule over the compact operators, because you can multiply on either side by matrices. And Zhang Jin and I thought about this. He not all K modules, bimodules, will be operator spaces, but he wrote down a very simple axiom for when a module, bimodule over the compact operators will in fact be an operator space. And it just corresponds to Juan's axioms over there. But here I've written it down explicitly. We have, it's a module over, these are compact operators, these are in your module, and you have this inequality, which just corresponds to the operator space calculation that I've given over there. This is a very common sort of trick that matrices can be used in very nice ways, which are not available to you when you're working with Banach spaces. And what he pointed out was that if you have a completely bounded mapping between V and W, the corresponding mapping, which you call the limit of the phi n's, will be a bounded mapping. And in fact, the norm is just the usual Banach space norm of this mapping K of phi. And this mapping K will send you, you call this a functor, from the completely bounded maps from V to W to the module maps. In other words, what he's saying is replace operator spaces by K modules, replace mappings by K module mappings, and then you never have to think about completely bounded anymore. This is purely Banach algebra theory, a Banach space theory in which you're working with modules over the compact operators. But there is a basic problem which I never saw a good way of getting around. There may be some way of doing it, and Barry worked on it too. but it doesn't look that convincing. I mean, he had sort of an artificial way of avoiding it. Let's discuss that a little bit. Remember, I said that one of the most important notions in operator space theory is the fact that the mapping space is, again, an operator space. But when you're working with modules, bimodules here in this case, and you take the K-module maps from here to here, the resulting space of mappings is no longer a K-module. This is a general phenomenon in module theory that when you take mappings of when you take mappings of modules, K-modules, if the ring is not commutative, then you don't get a module. You get outside the category. So here's the general algebraic problem. If you have a non-commutative ring and you have two left R modules, this thing over here is not an R module. Here's the calculation. You see what's going on. Then that natural way to define multiplying a mapping by R would be just to say it's R times phi of x. But the trouble, that's no longer an R module mapping, because if you put an S over here, it won't commute past the R. So it's the non-commutative aspect of the ring that causes the problem here. Now, what you could do is still try to force the issue, and this is what Barry was suggesting. For operator spaces in K-modules, you redefine the notion of Hom. If you think categorically, the objects in a category need not be points. And similarly, the objects in the Hom need not be mappings in any precise sense when you first think about them. And so you can define them any way you want. And he defined this thing to be the K-module maps, and then you tensor it with the compact operators. And you can regard this as a mapping from K of V into this module over here, where you just let K of W be the one-by-one term in the infinite matrices over here. It's not a completely satisfactory procedure, but I wonder what algebraists do. I noticed that in the literature on modules, they occasionally talk about a module being a module over a ring. And what they mean by that is that each Hom is a module over that ring. Now, I've just seen it defined, but I haven't seen any examples, because they usually say right after that, a good example is if your ring is abelian. So I don't know if there's a literature there or not. But it would be nice in principle, but you know, it could be that this is an attempt to force, unnaturally force, a quantized object into a classical object. I mean, I've wasted so much time thinking about this that I like to associate it with some very, very deep thing. Of course, it's probably I'm just wasting my time. And one thing that Zhang Jin and I did prove was this intriguing identity. This was back in the 80s, that if you take the Hagerup tensor product, which I'm not going to define today, that's one of the most fascinating new phenomena in operator space theory, and you multiply, you take the compacts of this, K of that, that's just tensoring with the compacts, you find that you get the Banach space tensor product, module tensor product of these two things. And I don't know what to make of that. It's an intriguing identity. And when we wrote the paper, we said, aha, maybe this really shows that the Hagerup tensor product type bilinear mappings are the correct ones when you're talking about multilinear mappings. But it hasn't gone any further. But those of you who are interested in foundations might like to pursue these ideas further. The operator space theory goes in many, many different directions. Probably the easiest direction to talk about in an introductory lecture like this is the notions of the simple ways that you can associate an operator space with a classical Banach space. And we have that the simplest way of associating or quantizing a Banach space. What do we mean by quantizing? We have to associate a bunch of norms on the n-by-n matrices. You can always do that in many ways. And the simplest way to do it is if you have an n-by-n matrix, you can give it the norm of x. I have to define what the norm of it is. Well, you just simply take linear functionals in the dual space of norm 1, and you apply fn of x to it. And that's a rather unfortunate way of saying it. Here's a much more concrete way of quantizing it. You know that your Banach space sits inside of L infinity of some set S, and in turn, your L infinity of S sits as the diagonal of the as the diagonal operators on the Hilbert space L2 of S. So therefore, E is sitting inside of B of H, and therefore it has a natural operator space, relative operator space structure. And you can show that does not depend on the initial embedding of E into L infinity of S. But I've given up there a more abstract definition, which doesn't require an actual embedding into an L infinity of S. And we have that the norm of Xn, the minimum norm, is this given by that supremum norm. In the case of a space X or S, you would just be using the point evaluations for those functions F. And then there's a corresponding maximal tensor product in which you could use arbitrary size matrices over there, V into MK, but it suffices to look at the N by N matrices, and I have the unit, that little one there indicates the unit ball. These are mappings. It doesn't use any operator space structure, and that should be an E over there, not a V. This is your way we're quantizing this space E. And that will give you another norm. And if your space happens to be an operator space, it follows from our previous remarks, namely this one over, and I've already deleted it, taking it off, from our earlier remarks, that it lies in between this norm and this norm. These really are the minimum and maximum quantizations in that sense. By considering norm matrix norms between these two, you get all possible operator spaces. And that's because of this fact that we can compute the norm of V by using suitable functions, the completely bounded functions for that space V. And these quantizations have certain categorical properties, you might call them. For the minimum space, if you have a mapping from any operator space into the minimal operator space, you'll find that that mapping has norm just the usual Banach space norm. If you turn things around and you put the maximal operator space over here, you get a corresponding result. And there's a duality between these two. The dual of the minimum quantization is the maximum quantization of E star. Okay. I introduced those in order to talk about a few interesting operator spaces, finite dimensional ones. Namely, let's look at, as our space, our Banach space, just little L1 sub n with the usual L1 norm. And then I consider two other spaces, two other vector spaces. I take the functions z1 through zn on the torus, which the continuous functions on the torus can also be thought of as the C star algebra of the z to the n. And I let vn be a corresponding non-commutative analog of that, namely, you take the generators not of the free abelian group, but of just the free group F sub n, and you take the linear span of those. Those are three different finite dimensional, obviously isomorphic finite dimensional spaces, and in fact, they are isometric. And let me point out the I claim that the mapping from En into Zn, where you take E1 into Z1, linear mapping, is isometric, and that's true because, in other words, I claim you get the L1 norm. Even though you're inside of this thing, which has the usual sup norm, when you compute the sup norm of this linear combination, all you're doing is you're taking the supremum over all scalars of absolute value 1, and by just simply choosing these alpha i's to the zeta i's, rather, to be to adjust for the alpha I, just to give you the absolute value, have absolute value 1, you obviously get the L1 norm. And that means that I have an isometry of En into L infinity of something. That must mean I'm getting the minimum quantization Zn. This is a more subtle fact, that the maximal quantization is nothing but what you get by embedding little L1n inside of the C-star algebra of the free group on n generators. And one result is obvious. If you take the mapping from En into Vn, taking your Ek into Uk, the generators of the free group, you have that that is certainly norm decreasing by this universal argument, Banach space argument. These generators all have norm 1 in the full C-star algebra. Incidentally, this full C-star algebra is obtained by taking all possible representations on Hilbert spaces and taking the soup norm determined by them. And that, by these categorical properties, means that there's a complete contraction of the maximal quantization to Vn, of this mapping that I just wrote down. Just by showing it's norm decreasing, you know automatically it's a complete contraction. We have to go the other way, though, now. And what we do is we fix a representation of the operator space. Any operator space can be embedded in B of H by Rouen's theorem, and we fix any one of those. And we let Ej go into some contractive operator B sub J. We then take this B sub J and dilate it to a unitary, a 2x2 matrix, common trick in this area, and that should obviously lead us to the free group. Remember, the free group will have automatically, if you have n unitaries, you can automatically send the generators into the unitaries. Unitaries are a group, this property of the free groups. So there we are. We're mapping the unitaries of the free group into the corresponding dilations, Uj into Vj. Notice that the dilation is on H2 rather than H itself. And automatically, you see, you have that this free group gets embedded into this group here. That's a property of free groups, that you have n elements of a group. Then the generators go into the generators, extends to homomorphism of the free group. And in turn, this homomorphism determines a mapping of the full C-star algebra into B of H2, which is a star homomorphism. Now, star homomorphisms are automatically completely contractive, something I didn't mention, but it's easy to see. And then what we do is we simply truncate, namely we have 2x2 matrices, we take the upper left-hand corner. And you find that what you end up with is the mapping of the CU1 through CUN into CB1 through CBN, which is giving you the realization of the maximum one, is a complete contraction. So indeed, we have proved the line here. The maximal of En is Vn. So there you see the very fascinating algebraic aspects of the difference between a maximal and minimal tensor product.
Sense,
the maximal one is unique automatically in these usual categorical ways. You know automatically that, and the infimum also, because that property, the first definition is an abstract property. It's canonical, right?
Maybe extended to
any operator space. Oh, now if you take arbitrary Banach spaces, any Banach space has a maximal quantization, which is unique. And the minimal one is unique. And you can show they're unique just by their universal properties, mapping properties. And it's not so easy to calculate what they are. And
for what space they would coincide?
I don't think they coincide for any except the complex numbers. So maybe the 2x2s, L2.
Any space of dimension bigger than 5 can coincide.
Bigger than 5.
Bigger than 5. Three and more.
Three more. Okay.
But n infinity 2,
yes.
And then 1, 2, this is Bjorn Poulsen's
stuff. Right, min equals max for those two.
Min equal to max is not known if it's any ones.
It's unknown if there are any others. Okay. Not
because,
too many of them.
Because Banach spaces is a metric.
No, it's complex. It's complex.
These are all complex spaces. Also, the Hilbert spaces have a vast array. Finite dimensional Hilbert space has a vast array of quantizations, and we're about to mention that. I think Gilles and Marius proved it's non-separable, right? The Hilbert space ones, there's in the natural metric, even for finite dimensional space. There are a vast array And in fact, you see, the whole point of operator spaces is they remember where they came from. In some sense, when you take the generators of the free group on N elements, as a Banach space, it's just L1N. Not very interesting. But its operator space structure essentially contains the free group, the full free group. Okay, so that's the... Okay, so next we go to... it's 810, right? Not 8. That's 9. Oh, let me finish this up here. So let's talk about finite dimensional spaces in general. And there's this very beautiful theory, often called the local theory of Banach spaces, which discusses finite dimensional Banach spaces and how they're assembled to form an infinite dimensional Banach space in principle. And we have that in the Banach space situation, you can approximate any finite, a given Banach space, L, by very special Banach spaces, finite dimensional ones, namely subspaces of finite sequence spaces. I am not consistent. I should have my L infinity up there, my N down here. As you can see, I've become completely schizophrenic now reading the Banach space literature. And the way you get these approximations, one crude way of looking at it, is you embed L into L infinity. You don't need a... All you have to use is a countable set. Little L infinity is enough for a finite dimensional space. And then you truncate it, and you let Ln be the image, and you have that L is approximated by these images over here, approximated in the Banach-Maser distance sense, where we have the distance between two finite dimensional spaces is this usual formula. This is not really a metric. It's the exponential of a metric. And so it ends up, things are close if they're close to 1. So you take the inf of these, and you can get these Ln's converging to L. And that's the crucial difference between operator spaces, or certainly one of the crucial differences, and Banach spaces. You see, when you're working with finite dimensional operator spaces, you can try the same trick. And Gilles was the first person to look at this. Namely, you look at the completely bounded distance between L and M, the same formula, but of course you're using isomorphisms which are completely bounded, and you use their completely bounded norms. And you want to try the same trick. You can take your finite dimensional space, put it inside the bounded operators on little L2, and then truncate those operators to N by N matrices, and hopefully the images of this mapping will approximate your L. This would hopefully go to 0. Well, unfortunately, that isn't the case. There are the problem is that the completely bounded norm requires looking at infinitely many dimensions. You can't do it uniformly. In other words, you can take care of the 2x2 matrices, the 3x3 matrices, but you can't take care of all of them simultaneously with that type of approximation. And we say that a space is exact if you can do that type of approximation, that this is a finite dimensional space, that there's some linear subspace of the p-by-p matrices which is close, arbitrarily close to L. That's when an operator space is exact. An example of a non-exact space, that's why we want to have a few spaces around, is this max L1n. It's non-exact. On the other hand, there is a different C-star algebra, the reduced C-star algebra, on the free group on N generators, and that is the corresponding finite dimensional space is exact. This is a notion, exactness goes back to Kirchberg. It's a beautiful key notion which continues to play an important role in operator algebras. And but here we see it, that it's a notion that can be defined on the level of operator spaces. It's really an operator space notion. In fact, I would claim that almost most of the invariants of C-star algebra theory and operator algebra theory are really invariants of their underlying operator spaces. And an intriguing aspect of this is notice that, in fact, this max L1n is really not such a mysterious object, abstractly speaking. It's the dual of this operator space. You may think L and then infinity is a Banach space, but it's a von Neumann algebra. It's a finite dimensional one. It's an operator space. And not, I won't bother to write in min over here, because that is the same as the min. This is the dual of this. So very simple spaces will have non-exact duals. The same can show you that the these arguments can show you that the dual of the n by n matrices is not exact. But many C-star algebras are exact. All nuclear C-star algebras, all type 1, all nuclears are exact, and there are many non-exact, like that free C-star algebra. I should explain what I mean when I say a whole C-star algebra is exact. What I mean is that in general, for an arbitrary infinite dimensional operator space, we say it's exact if all of its finite dimensional subspaces are exact. Now, why is this so important, this fact that you don't have exactness? And here we get into a somewhat technical discussion. I like to say that, everybody says it, that in operator space theory, the key technique is tensor products. And if you want to translate some notion from Banach space theory to operator space theory, it's often best to think, well, what does this mean if you think of it as a tensor product property? And we have that tensor products are a very convenient way of translating questions like local reflexivity into operator space theory. And that was roughly, that's the route that I'll take right now very quickly. And let me remind you that for finite dimensional vector spaces, there's this relationship between tensor products and mapping spaces. That's what Grothendieck took advantage of in his work. In general, he wanted to find relations between tensor products and mapping spaces. But this is very elementary, and everything I say here is really elementary. We want, in the algebraic case, to remember that you can consider that tensor product, that's the dual vector space for finite dimensional space, that you can identify the tensor product with linear mappings in the obvious way. Those look at an elementary tensor, F tensor X, and that'll obviously give you a mapping from L into M. X is in M. And also the dual of a tensor product can be viewed as linear mappings into the dual space. And if you combine those two, you get the dual of, these are finite dimensional spaces, is the tensor product of the duals. When you get to Banach spaces, there's a similar theory. You take the minimal injective tensor product, I guess it used to be called lambda, I don't know what it's called these days. You take E star lambda F, the bounded mappings from E into F, which are in the uniform closure of the finite rank mappings. And we have that, here we have the projective tensor product. This is the analog of the second property, are the bounded mappings from E into F star. If you want to get that last equality, you have to let one of the spaces, say, be finite dimensional. And we get that the dual of the projective tensor product is the injective tensor product of these two, because this thing over here will be the same as B naught of LF. So you can go to the first line. That in turn, but then the question that Grothendieck asked was, well, what happens if you turn that around? What if you take the dual of the injective tensor product? Do you get the projective? And the answer turns out to be yes, and that's a rather subtle result. And the reason why it's true is because Banach spaces are exact, finite dimensional ones. You can approximate them by subspaces of L and infinity. For the case L and infinity, it's very easy to check that these things are, this equality is true. And we have that, this in turn implies that when you take the second dual, you get L, that's a finite dimensional space, minimal tensor product F double star. And what this really means, I indicate over here, is that if you have a mapping from, remember that these things over here can be regarded as mappings from L star into F double star, and it has norm less than or equal to 1. It can be approximated by mappings into F of norm less than or equal to 1. To write this equality is saying that they're isometric. It isn't just Rice saying that they are, they're automatically, algebraically isomorphic. That's not the point. It's the isometry aspect. And that's this part over here. But operator spaces need not be locally reflexive. And we can't use the argument for Banach spaces because there are lots of non-exact operator spaces. And, in fact, one has that you can do the same sort of constructions for operator space theory, and we have the minimal tensor product, the projective tensor product. There are corresponding constructions which give you corresponding rules. You have this question, is this the same thing? Does one have an analog of the Grothendieck thing? And said the answer is no. You can't always approximate complete contractions from a finite dimensional space into W double star by complete contractions into W. And therefore, we have a definition. When something doesn't work, you make a definition. You define a space to be locally reflexive if you can do those approximations. And there's a notion of nuclearity for operator spaces. We have nuclear implies exact implies locally reflexive. That's not readable there. C star of F2 is not locally reflexive, the full C star algebra. So now we come to our last slide here. One of the most gratifying results was working with my brilliant young colleagues, Marius Junge and Zhang Jinruan, was that we discovered that, lo and behold, the pre-dual of any von Neumann algebra is automatically locally reflexive. That was quite a surprise, because there are lots of C star algebras and von Neumann algebras which aren't. Remember, you're going to have to go to infinite dimensionals to get examples. Finite dimensional spaces are automatically reflexive in this category. And we have corresponding things that I can write down for you for that might hammer down these new tensor products. Remember that the minimal tensor product will give you ln infinity of E. That's another way of writing this thing over here is the minimal tensor product. Minimal tensor product will give you of continuous functions on compact spaces, has that nice categorical interpretation. When you take the projective tensor products of L1 spaces, you get the correct space. When you go to operator spaces, the analog of that first one is this one over here. If you have C star algebras, this is nothing but the usual minimal tensor product of C star algebras. You could consider that sort of the analog of this result over here. And if you have von Neumann algebras, this is the analog of this result over here. We have that the projective tensor product of the pre-duals of von Neumann algebras will give you the pre-dual of the spatial tensor product, the usual tensor product of von Neumann algebras. This means there's a new way of interpreting tensor products of von Neumann algebras. They're nothing but mapping spaces, that the completely bounded maps from R lower star into S. This was really known back in the late 50s because Tomiyama was always talking about slice mappings, and that's what slice mappings are formalized in this manner over here. And let me end with what has been torturing me for at least 5 years, and that is the question. I find the free probability extremely beautiful. It's already having significant impact on operator space theory. But is there a more abstract way? I overindulge myself with abstractions. Is there an analog of this projective tensor product result for the free product of two 2-1 factors? Let's take, in particular, say, where you take the L infinity of the integers, free product L infinity of the integers, little L infinity of the C star algebra of the integers, free products, you get the free group on two generators. How do you compute the pre-dual of this? And you see what's intriguing is this is the L1 space, and we do know what the L2 space is. That's one of the first things that Voigt-Lescu did was he used this Fox space type theory. So what you're really looking for is some sort of L1 Fox construction. This is actually very common in the subject. Namely, operator spaces are particularly well designed for abstract questions. Maybe it's because they're such abstract objects. So that categorical things are easy to check, like those maximal tensor product thing, the maximal operator space calculations. But what gets more difficult is when you're not working with universal objects. The reduced C-star algebra is in many ways more concrete and much, and perhaps more important than the full C-star algebra, but we don't know how to interpret it from an operator space point of view because it really requires more analysis, more algebra has to be used, more understanding has to be used. Thank you.
Questions? Comments?
Yes?
You've been a little vague about exactly what you mean by quantization, but in these completely bounded maps, there are representation theorems.
Yes, I didn't state any of them.
That you didn't say anything about, which sure. Actually have a physical interpretation.
Correct.
Namely, that your system can be regarded as a subsystem of a much larger system.
That is exactly
right. And
I'm wondering
if when things break down, for example, when you get these, when you try to get the real abstract module construction and you, the products are not in there, if there might be a physical interpretation that you no longer can are in a situation where you are in a subsystem of a larger system.
Well, in fact, if one looks at the literature, say on quantum computers, you find a lot of discussion of completely positive maps.
Right.
Now, that's one slight difference. There is, just as in functional analysis, there's ordered functional analysis, Quine's theorem type of thing, and you have the pure Banach space theory. Here again, you have that dichotomy. And you have that the earlier theory, the theory of operator systems, was the correct generalization of the notion of a function system. It's the correct ordered notion. And the physical notions are seem more to be connected with that than with the operator space theory. And in the case of, this is just off the top of my head, when you're looking at operator systems, some of these things disappear. Some of the problems disappear. But, you know, it's funny because convexity is physically much more important, but mathematically is, you know, that's why people do Banach space theory rather than ordered Banach space theory. That it's, it could be that there is some physical way of looking at this, but remember, there is a canonical operator space structure. It's something wrong with the modules, not with the operator space structure, because that's what's revolutionized the subject.
That was my point.
Yeah.
The modules are telling you that you're getting out of what's physically realized.
Yeah, well, I think that Johnson's right, that there is a module way of doing it, that it's something that algebraists probably have already done, that when you're dealing with a non-commutative ring, how do you get ring modules? I would guess that's known, that maybe what they're using is the fact that K is isomorphic to K tensor K, or something like that. I don't know. Okay, thank you.
The property is